Paul Marion was born in Lowell, Massachusetts in 1954 as a graduate of the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And since 1978, he's been a publisher of Loom Press, a company that focuses on writers and subjects from the Merrimack River watershed. He's the author of several collections of poetry, and this afternoon he's going to read from his most recent collection called Union River, a book that was incidentally published by Bootstrap Press, who come here often to read stuff, Ryan and Garrett. So Paul is, you know, so this is the second time Paul's been here. And I was thinking about this morning about the commonality between Gloucester and Lowell, and you know, we're both old American cities, and we connect through literary history, whether it's Kerouac or Olson, and we also connect through our industrial history. And so both these New England towns came into existence because of the industry that generated from that watery part of the world, be it riverine or oceanic. So today, when I was thinking about Paul reading here, I was also thinking about the guy who lived in this place that he has a lot in common with. In fact, I think Vincent's typewriter was right here where he pounded out a bunch of poetry over his career. And like Vincent, Paul's involved in the life of his community as a writer that looks at our shared American experience through a variety of lenses. As a Franco-American writer, he looks through the lens of ethnicity and immigration. As a contemporary writer, he has a special view of his city and its place in history and literature. And lastly, as a Lowell homeboy, his personal experience reminds us that art is the handmaid of human good. So with that, here he is. I got to sit down.
Well, thank you, Henry. It's great to be back. It's great to see everybody, some new faces, some familiar faces. Whenever I read, I like to start by quoting Walt Whitman, who said, "To have great poets, there must be great audiences." So you're the great audience today. It keeps all the writers going. We appreciate it. Treat to be, you know, invited to read here. This place sort of has a vibe, resonates. I was digging around in my old copy of the Maximus poems by Charles Olson yesterday, because I thought maybe it'd be nice to read the Gloucester thing, you know, just to get started. And I had forgotten that Vincent Farini, you know, figures so prominently in the Maximus poems, letter number 5. And there's a section here that I just wanted to read, and it's Olson, Maximus, you know, kind of addressing Vincent Farini as a writer in the community, and Vincent is publishing a literary magazine called Four Winds, and Olson has become aware of it. He says, "I'll try once more to meet you. What about Sterling's drug? Is that where you are? Surely not at the library. Or you'd at least show that Corrections, which so many of the other little magazines now know show, the schoolboy renaissance. As you are differently adither with that future, so many of your pieces show the looseness of the search, the Steiner mystique. The mind, Farini, is as much of a labor as to lift an arm flawlessly or to read sand in the butter on the end of the lead and be precise about what sort of bottom your vessel's over. I begin to be damned to figure out where we can meet. I like your own house." Is he talking about this house? No.
Probably out on East Main Street.
"That first day I sought you out, you'll recall I came to your door just because I had read a poem by you in just such a little magazine as you now purport to edit. A magazine does have this life to it, proper to it, does have streets, can show lights, movie houses, bars, and occasionally, for those of us who do live our life quite properly in print, as properly, say, as Gloucester people live in Gloucester, you do meet someone, as I met you, on a printed page. So there's Vincent up there. So we're on the coast, and this book, this is my sort of State of the Union book. My last two books were really kind of deep dives into Lowell. In 2006, I published What is the City, which was a kind of retrospective of poems and short prose pieces, all sort of about Lowell. And then in 2014, I wrote a history book, sort of, you know, modern history of the city, called Mill Power, which talks about how Lowell became a national park and what difference that has made. So I said, I have to, you know, kind of remind people, I get out of, you know, Lowell sometimes. So, you know, this book was intended, I started about 5 years ago. I sent it out to, you know, contests and, you know, didn't have any luck publishing it. And, I didn't want to do it through my own press, you know, in this instance, and I was able to find some supportive guys, you know, in Lowell at Bootstrap Press, who publish writers from all over the country, and they said that, yeah, they wanted to do it. So they did a, you know, really great job, and I was happy to work with them. Just a quick commercial. We have books in the back by Michael and me, and today, there's a one-day-only $5 price, for people who are good enough to come to the reading. So I thought, because we're on the coast, one of the things I do here is read poems from the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast, because I happen to have written about both places. So the first piece is called Merrimack Port. It's a long piece, longish for me, and it came out of looking at a map on the wall in the beach house that Rosemary and I have in Hampton Beach, and my boyhood friend Kevin Hall is here. He's from Northampton, so he'll connect with this here. And it's, you know, it's Olsen-ish in a way. I probably write the way I, you know, some of the way I write, you know, because of Charles Olsen. So, you know, it's another reason why it's wonderful to come here to Gloucester and have a chance to read here. Merrimack Port. Driving north through the Summer Green Valley, I tick off place names, Andover, Lawrence, Haverhill, and then Merrimack Port. Next time I'll exit right to see past a sign. It must be less than small city Newburyport, where money-running merchants made the killing that raised the mills upriver toward the interior, where falls foam in the rush, clear power rounding bedrock jags. There were once shipmasters and boat builders in the yards from Cape Ann to Portsmouth, captains on High Street, hands who turned their backs on the square clocks and tower bells and red stacks of mill towns, traders, counters and sailmakers, lumbermen felling pines, mast makers and carpenters hammering ships' knees, coopers, wheelwrights, and smiths, food handlers and butchers, painters, spice grinders, tailors and seamstresses, hatters and pipe makers, cobblers, corn farmers, orchard men, the physician and ministers, teachers, midwives, selectmen and stable hand, map maker and depth sounder, the lookout, the scout, the soldier, spirit maker, tavern maid and dry goods seller, boarding house keeper and sheriff, all these types pacing a day in sight of a sea-stuck forest past the dock, the working boats and broad ships just back or ready to go. What cargo, Merrimack Port? What story in the hold? What distance, Merrimack Port, where the river runs to salt? The river runs past Deer and Ram Islands, past Seal and Woodbridge Islands, past Gangway Rocks, Half-Tide Rocks, and Toothpick, past Black Rocks and Black Rock Creek, and Outer Badger, past Plum Island and Plum Island River, past Pine Island River, Joppa Flats, and Salisbury Beach, and all that the ocean brought, knowledge, material, gold, came landward down the plank, stamped the ground, made the next thing happen. The sea took a bite of sand, moon in the glass, wave cream, rapids mane, pepper in a jar on the shelf, sailcloth needles, squared nails, boots with a belt to match. The lighthouse keeper made a hole in the fog. This puts us a sort of season ahead. This next piece is called Sharks Rip the Nets. People always wonder, like, where do poems come from? You know, and I heard something in the news that there was this situation where sharks were actually going after fishing nets, and it was almost a way of nature trying to control the balance. And I was so fascinated with that idea, and it sort of opened up into a lyric poem. Sharks rip the nets. Sharks rip the nets, keeping us from taking too much. Silverfish dive, engines run hot. Cottage glass shines like blue gin. Sand wheat inscribes the dunes. Planks and long country poles lean against houses until patching days. Oil thickens in a can. Drawers of yarn will empty after Christmas. The artery, a sheet metal freeze. Fear of surf that could blast a body to cream puts a leash on the scout. For the sight of a lilac blooming, I'd like to sue the stars. In my 20s, spent quite a bit of time in Maine. I had a friend who was sort of homesteading up there. Ended up writing, quite a few poems sort of, with Maine as the place. This piece actually, Kathy Aponik, sort of connects to this piece because, I was invited to go to an island, off the coast in Frenchman's Bay up by Bar Harbor by, an old friend of ours, Steve Perrin, who owned the island, the poet Steve Perrin. And he was in a poetry group in Andover that Kathy and I were both in. This was probably, 1977 or something like that. And the poem goes like this. Burying Island, marking tide levels, Steed Buck's home routines. Above the rockweed cove, he built a cabin. An all-weather den ferried piecemeal in his dory and hauled up a cliff on his back. Spruce roots sideways. In the rocky soil, trees a straw to nor'easters. He picks up splintered sea snails gulls drop onto rocks. Clam chips speckle a sandbank where the mound people ate fish. Sand fleas jitter the seaweed beach at noon. Cormorants clatter into flight. Wings slapping madly off water. Bright green eelgrass oscillates at high tide. Moss pads a rough ledge where a head with quartz eyes stares like an Easter Island giant. At night, the Bar Harbor hills, a hump serpent on the coast, show a necklace of traffic, part of the turnpike herd still roaring out of the toll booths like thoroughbreds. This is a... So a little bit more updated poem, a little bit different structure. This is in four parts. That's what it looks like on the page. It came out, it was sort of like fragments that I had, and I said, well, can I put this together, make something, a composition that hang together? So this is what I was the result. The title is Ball of Confusion, Sea of Tranquility, 1. There's a sign at the Bangor shopping mall seeking the owner of an inflatable woman found in the parking lot. Did she fly off the roof of her apartment house? Did she escape from a car where the owner went shopping? Did she step on a nail while running away? 2. In one dream, I'm piloting an oil tanker in a small harbor. The ship keeps scraping the bottom and bashing the dock. The engine speeds up without warning. I keep forgetting my hands are on the wheel. 3. John Haynes quotes Edwin Muir in Living Off the Country. Quote, our minds are possessed of 3 mysteries: where we came from, where we are going, and since we are not alone, but members of a countless family, how should we live with one another? I saw the aurora borealis behind the chair and swan outlined in starry dots. The moon surfaced like a yellow stone, then turned the color of peace. Ghost fish leapt at light like the first lizards, plucking feet from the muck. Dazzled eyes turned up. So going across the country now, I'll read a few pieces from my time, my experiences in California. I lived there twice, once as a kid for part of a year, and then once as a graduate student at University of California, Irvine. I was in Southern California at that point. When I was a kid, I was up north. This is called Sunday Morning in Canada. I used to listen to public radio, and I was in Dana Point, which is halfway between San Diego and Los Angeles, and the public radio station in San Diego, sort of oddly enough, had us sort of syndicated broadcasts of a program called Sunday Morning in Canada, you know, which I thought, what, you know, this seems crazy, right? But, I, you know, they have to fill their time, right? So it must have been available to the public radio network, so they just put it in, right? Yeah, what?
Price is Right.
Yeah, Price is Right, right, yeah. So this is called Sunday Morning in Canada. The odd, and I'm French-Canadian, you know, so there's like identity thing sort of going on here. Sunday Morning in Canada. The odd offering of Canadian news sprayed from a San Diego tower to my radio an hour north by car raised questions about fact and happening. Parliamentary debates affect Yellowknife and St. Jean de Mata. Beirut smoke and Olympic medals garnish breakfast plates in Toronto. And here I am in salsa country, eavesdropping on continental bulletins, as if it must matter to know as much as I can about anything being done anywhere. I can't stop listening to the planet getting older. Somehow, I'll need this as much as the fruit and vegetables at Ralph's Market. Why else would I be able to tap into the line? Still, there's probably a better reason I keep turning north when I'm so far south that people walk here from Mexico. Reports flow back and forth like weather ridges, high pressure systems, like acid rain and waterfowl, all in the air. This next piece is called Dana Point. I was in Dana Point, I came to realize this name for Richard Henry Dana, who wrote the classic 2 years Before the Mass, which I hadn't read, you know. But he was a Massachusetts man, you know, you'll hear a little bit about him in here, but he winds up, you know, on the West Coast. I thought, well, that's interesting, you know. There's a epigraph here from 2 years Before the Mass, which, again, is very Olsen-ish, you know, using, you know, kind of primary documents, whatever. There's a quote, our cargo was an assorted one. That is, it consisted of everything under the sun. We had spirits of all kinds, raisins, molasses, hardware, crockeryware, boots and shoes from Lynn, calicos and cottons from Lowell, and dot, dot, dot. On Seville Lane, the condo units cozy up like pleasure boats in their slips. Across the street, garage industry. 2 women sew custom bikinis. A chocolate parcel truck picks up special orders every afternoon. Richard Dana quit Harvard College, set off to cure his eyesight. His ship, Pilgrim, rounded the Cape, rain, wind, salt, snow, fried air. This Pacific strip, Capistrano's beachhead, hails the writer in bronze. In Vaughn's Market on Ortega Drive, handling a blue plastic bowl molded in a plant upriver from the Lowell textile mills, it was made by it was a plastic company in Teensboro, Massachusetts, and you know there it was in the, you know, on Ortega Drive. I recall the ship's cargo, stuff we swap, like that tough New England cloth. Christmas 1834, just north of the equator, Dana writes, it brought us no holiday. 20 days from California, 100 plus from Boston, provisions had run out. Now jump to 1983, Pilgrim 2, the replica, rigged with colored lights and streamers. Flash bulbs pop in Dana West Marina at the Yuletide Parade of Boats. All the kids and captains harmonize on Little Saint Nick. Here's what I wrote on the beach, on Capistrano Beach. And there's a shout-out to my friend here on my right. It's called Helicopters for Turner Square. Iron chops the sky up and down this coast from Camp Pendleton to the Marine Air Base at El Toro. Maybe it's the palm trees, or because I'm picturing the surf sliding into Vietnam on the other hem of this ocean, but I can't help thinking these helicopters are from the war, the ones that carried wounded kids out of fire zones long enough ago that movies of the war seem old. I didn't have to go, but I can't get rid of it. My draft number was 62, the year the call-ups were suspended, and I still don't know what I would have done. I keep reading Casey's obscenities and Hur's dispatches, drawn to the mayhem. I wonder if young Daniel Turner from my home back east was stationed in California before shipping out. 6 years older than me, he was a sergeant in the Air Force when he died in Jiading province in 1969, a ground casualty per military records. A quiet guy who lived up the hill from my house, his name now tops a steel post set in a grassy crossroads where I caught my high school bus. Now it's a hero square, Turner Square. When I visited the bright black wall and hut and steamy white stone Washington, D.C., and felt the incisions in its mirror face, I searched for Sergeant Turner's name among the names that hold up all the signs at all the intersections. His dates are 31 January 48, 17 August 69, Daniel R. Turner. He's on panel 19 West, row 57, just like the neighborhood sign. And here was my So Long California poem. I had a chance to come back and work in Lowell, working on the development of the national park, and so I left graduate school midway. I was running out of money and thought, okay, I got enough out of this. So this is called Goodbye Laguna. This is about Laguna Beach, which was, you know, like, you know, some of the affluent communities, north of Boston, except palm trees. So Goodbye Laguna. At the four-way stop on Glenire, a Mercedes, a Jag, and a yellow Rolls stare at my basic green Lynx. The ease of wealth deceives in Laguna Beach, lets me think luxury is not extraordinary. A miniature composes in my side mirror. Bleached surf kids wait to cross Coast Highway, their swimsuits bright as crayons. He's outside my picture, but I'm sure the greeter is hailing traffic this morning, long beard and staff his trademarks. Across from the art market, gray panthers are in position, holding placards that shout, "No more Hiroshimas, honk for peace." And the incredible athletic specimens gathered on beachside courts are loosening up for a little hoop. And the women wear next to nothing. Sun turns the whole place into dessert, vitamin-rich, sweet, but low-cal, so-cal, absorbed by simply being here. Here, work seems unrelated to sweat. Shop clerks and gallery keepers act as if they're inside for a diversion. The Hotel Laguna valet kicks back in a lawn chair. My Catholic, liberal, Yankee conscience tells me someone must be suffering for this. Somewhere there will be pain to pay, but as far as I can see, we're all smiling. I'm just going to read two more. One, I mentioned my friend Kevin. We were in Catholic grade school together, and this poem sort of goes back to that. Where I grew up in Draket, which town just outside of Lowell, when I was small, there was a Air Force jet that crashed in the woods, which became this sort of mysterious happening that we would explore, a location we would explore. But then it sort of flips back in the poem and talks about the sort of the Catholic culture, you know, that we came up in. It's called Bush Pilots. The pilot sprouted from the cockpit, lobbed backwards until silk puffed, and his parachute, tiny mushroom, held in the wind over fur-crested woods. Part of our Air Force hobbled out of the sky toward Spears, where it caught entangled wings and splintered fuselage and cracked its nose cone as Silver Stars hit ground in a black and orange noise. For years, we dug up traces of burnt metal, once thinking our relic was a helmet chip, rare as the fossil of St. Teresa buried at our yellow brick school. We rummaged in the ruins for bits of wreck, not pieces of the dream, that lore of pretty steel. Like blue angels in a wild blue yonder, we hitched our saintly wagons to a star, but fumbled with the junk that fell around us. And I'll close with the poem that opens the book, actually. It's called Checking the Property. We're in quite a moment here in the country with the government and so forth. So this piece, you know, somehow you know, gained more currency in a way. it's called Checking the Property. My 9-year-old son says, I'm going to read the Gettysburg Address. What's the Lincoln shorthand? Freed the slaves, saved the Union. People crowd the marble steps at dusk. A sign asks for silence. When he sees my wife lining up a shot, a guy in a straw cowboy hat offers to take a picture of my wife, our son, and me. Climbing the stairs, I had caught sight of the figure behind columns and lost him due to the steep ascent, only to come upon the sculpture again near the top, where visitors gaze at the huge seated president whose massive square-toed boot juts out, looking as if it could kick Jefferson Davis's football the length of the reflecting pool and onto the white spike of the Washington Monument. At late day, reflecting sun on its narrow western face, a glow stick numeral standing for the first president who set the Constitutional Republic in motion. The stone blocks a different shade on the top half, marking a stop in work and return, a monument telling its own story, one in which protesters rolled cut stones into the drink in a struggle for control of the civic project, foreshadowing later conflicts and comings together on this electric stretch of public land without timber or copper, a wide open space in which to make a verb of America, to recall and exuberate and to do democratic research and development in a red clay lined lab crowded with evidence of an ongoing experiment and bearing key formulas in equations inscribed in stone. So thanks again. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm going to introduce Michael Casey now. Some people here know him, some know about him, some are just meeting him. Michael, you know, we have some things in common, both born in Lowell. I grew up in Draket, but he grew up in Lowell, went to Lowell High School and Lowell Technological Institute, where he was a physics major, the only physics major in the 120-year history of the school who won a National Poetry Prize. So he graduated in 1968 and was drafted and went to Vietnam and came back from that experience with a pile of writing that he put together and sent in for consideration for the most prestigious prize for a young poet in America, 1971, and he won. The book it's called Obscenities, and it was a phenomenon. It was published by Yale University Press and then remarkably issued in paperback as a mass market paperback. You know, I tell everybody, it was like Jonathan Livingston Seagull. It was everywhere. you know, his work is in the canon of American writing and certainly writing about war. He went on, published about 8 more books, including a book called Mill Rat about his experiences working in the sort of the crazy culture of the factories in Lowell, continued to publish. His work appeared in big and small places, New York Times, Rolling Stone magazine, dozens of small literary magazines, very, very widely published. I was honored when he contacted me and we started talking about doing an edition of his selected poems. The conversation started about 4 years ago, and the book came out in earlier this year. I think in May we did it in time for the Massachusetts Poetry Festival, so we could get it out there for visibility. It's called There It Is: New and Selected Poems. Getting a good reception. As the publisher, Loom Press, I get all sort of the inquiries and the orders. So everybody from the National Library of Scotland to the U.S. Air Force Academy to West Texas Community College Library, these places want Michael's book. So we're happy that it's getting out there, and we've read a couple times together because of the coincidence of both having new books. It's always great to be here with him. He lives in Andover, so he's still around here. And here's Michael. Yeah.
Well, I thank you, Henry, for the invite, and I thank you, Paul, for the introduction, and also for publishing my work. And sort of like financially irresponsible to publish poetry, but I appreciate it. Thank you. In Marlborough Street in Lowell, there was a hotel called the Marlborough, and this is a poem about the Marlborough. It's for Martin Moriarty. It used to be a nice hotel. My big sister married there, but before that, it was a private home. The guy built it was a millionaire, and our own textile town was the home of this guy that tried to corner the world market in copper. The woodwork in it was amazing, but by the time I lived there, it was seedy. Drunks and all kinds of deals going on. And who else there but Miss Mulligan, my teacher from junior high school? Well, a druggie's private lab starts a fire, and I run to get Miss Mulligan, and two punks there are robbing her apartment. It's like Rome burning. I'm yelling, "Get out of here. This place is on fire." And this lady's my geography teacher, but the lady doesn't want to leave her home. And the punks and I are trying to carry her out when engine number 7 from Stephen Street shows up. We get her out, and the paper is full of the heroic efforts of the fire department rescuing 4 recalcitrant residents. But the truth is, we almost got fried, just like the guy tried to corner copper in Lowell, Massachusetts. I was a physics major at college. This is relativity. In B326, Dr. Baker, PH 345, 3 credits, no lab, says, the relativistic force acting on a particle is F mu equals d d tau, open parenthesis, m naught dx mu dt, close parenthesis. This force is called the Minkowski force. And Joe Zostek, who sits behind me, says, hooray for the Polak. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the TV show The House of Cards, the American version. In the American version, Robin Wright's office manager is an actress, Marianne Plunkett, who is from Lowell. But really, she has credits on Broadway and as well as the theater. This story is actually a story from the sister of a friend, Marianne. For Marianne Plunkett, how would you like to stay out of school a couple of days? She was such a nice girl. She was so genteel. She just dabbed the poison ivy here and there on the arm, and I rubbed the poison ivy everywhere. I was so smart, I was absent for 2 weeks of agony. I never had a chance. She went on to fame and film and Broadway, and if I look at a picture of her, even now, I break out. Driving under the influence. It was 3 a.m. and I hit the blinking yellow light on the Route 3 rotary near Drum Hill. We get out quick to throw away beer cans, and then I backed up the car a bit and tried to go forward. But the car wouldn't go forward, so I backed up around the rotary and into a gas station. I figured I could put my car in the row of cars already there, and nobody would notice, right? I get out and hide behind, but by this time I see the flashing lights. And it was really something. The police cruiser goes around the rotary, takes the exit I took, and comes straight to me. I was alone, all my friends split, and they get me for leaving the scene, driving under the influence, being a minor in possession, all kinds of stuff, right? I asked the guy who found me, how do you catch me? He said he followed the leaking radiator. It leaked after the crash, right? 50 million dumb cops in the world, and this guy has to be a genius. If anybody has a job where they have to stand up all day, they always have foot problems, and I come from a family of barbers, and so I always heard problems about feet. Walter's sore feet. This was from a dye house at a textile mill in Lowell. I used to feel like picking up my fucking feet, putting them in my fucking pocket, and walking on my fucking knees. So now I do what my chiropractor says. I spend 10 minutes every night rolling my feet, each one over a bunch of golf balls in a shoebox. It's been helping me a lot, and once you get used to it, it's no trouble at all. Since I started using two shoeboxes, it's cut the time in half. Working in the mills, I would copy down scraps of dialogue or stories I heard. I mentioned here a B&E. This is a criminal offense, breaking and entering. Just one B&E. Once they got me for sniffing glue, which almost don't count because like it was nothing, but then there was just one B&E was all they got me for, just one, but no more. Because I'm a good boy now, I promised my mother. But if anybody needs any power tools, let me know by before this weekend. As far as my mother's concerned, good boys are ones don't get caught. The speaker in this poem is actually a white-collar worker. He was promoted. I believe his title was the superintendent of the factory. My youngest that tall. They kept on sending him home last year. The fucking kid was always acting up. So last summer, all through the summer, they were building a new school near the house. And we kept on pointing out the fucking thing, trying to get the kid interested, you know. See the school they're building for you? That sure is a nice-looking school. So the wife takes him to the second grade to register, and the kid looks around him, and right in front of the teacher, he says to her, "I ain't staying in this fucking place." My wife said she felt about this fucking tall. Well, there used to be a comic strip called Pogo. It was political, but the residents in Pogo were animals from a swamp in the south. Now, the author, Walt Kelly, I don't think he was ever in the service, but during World War II, he had a job where he was near southern soldiers, and the way they talk, their idiom, really entertained him immensely, and that started the characters. The famous expressions, "We have met the enemy and he is us." Well, the sergeant here is a Mississippi sergeant. The company physical combat proficiency test average. The company average be higher, but Ramos there went into the mile run with a near 400, burnt smoke for the first three laps, and then he got sick. And a committee group sergeant there, another Puerto Rican fellow, told him to quit, to leave. And so he got a zero on the whole test. And that brought the company average down a point and a half. In my opinion, Ramos got fucked. He could have low-crowd his ass the rest of the way and still have got a 450 score. If I'd have seen that sergeant there, I'm not scared of nobody. I'd have beat the shit out of him. But don't feel bad, Ramos. What's done is did. That's all right, son. You get another chance tomorrow. Though that don't help the company average none. There was a lot more to that. He actually heard that some white trainees were going to beat up Ramos because he failed this test. And he was actually telling people, don't beat up the kid. It wasn't his fault. I was not very fond of this drill sergeant. He had told me various things. Among them was, but I don't have the sense that God promised a carrot. He said, I had a lot of guts, but not gut. But he meant it the other way around. I knew exactly what he meant. It's all context, I guess. I was sent to a military police school. I had very little aptitude for being a policeman. But, you know, it's you showing up one day at a time. And this is a California military policeman, Master Antonio and the Rhinoceros Beetle. And the setting is in Missouri. Master Antonio looks and points to something on the ground and yells, "Boo, man, hey, wow, look at that, will ya? That is a rhinoceros beetle, but I never seen one that big. I never seen one that ugly. It looks like Markham when he wakes up in the morning. Shit, it looks like Markham any time of day. Don't get too close. That can really hurt you. Give me a pencil. Give me something it can latch onto. Hey, Markham, give me your finger." And Markham gives Master Antonio a finger. I was in Missouri for 8 months, roughly. I got to wear a white hat. I carried a weapon with me, a .45. I also wore white gloves. It was really a feeling of power of some kind since I grew up with cowboy shows, you know. Well, I was levied out to go to Vietnam. The first four lines were from a sign at the Oakland Army base, signage, I guess. You know. Welcome. Welcome to Building 950, Gateway to the Pacific. Group leaders report to shipping office. No females allowed. Gentlemen, attendance at these mandatory formations is of primary concern with us group leaders. I want to see all you smiling faces with me in the big country. Also, we'll be flying on an airplane with two young ladies, gentlemen, with two stewardesses. Your American soldiers and grown-up men, construct yourselves accordingly. In Vietnam, I was still a military policeman, but I gave out traffic tickets on Highway 1 during the day. At nighttime, we hid on our base. We did not go out except for rare circumstances. I was stationed on a base that had an armored unit, H Troop, 1st of the 1st Cavalry. They had tanks and armored personnel carriers. I'm not sure what a psychiatrist would say about the names on the vehicles, but the troops would give the vehicles various names. It's called a bummer. We were going single file through his rice paddies, and the farmer started hitting the lead track with a rake. He wouldn't stop. The track commander went to talk to him, and the farmer tried to hit him too. So the tracks went sideways, side by side, through the guy's fields, instead of single file. Hard on, Proud Mary, Bummer, Wallace, Rosemary's Baby, the Rutgers Roadrunner, and Go Get 'em, Done Got 'em went side by side through the fields. If you have a farm in Vietnam and a house in hell, sell the farm and go home. Deploy, deploy. The landing zone has a middle of the night drill, and the brigade guard squad deploys quick as hell. We sky there less than a minute, and this officer walks around, asks if we got our flak jacket. That's evident, eh? And then he asks, how much ammo you got? I didn't even have a clip. A real pisser for a drill, even. April Fool's Day, they hit us real, and piss burner goes around again, right to the same hole I'm hiding in, ready for him this time. 171 bullets, sir, 19 per clip, 8 clips in a bandolier. He says, that's not 171. I says then, and 1 clip in the rifle, sir, locked and loaded, sir. Some people, you know, they kick at a hanging. Well, I'll leave it now, gradually, gladly. After the service, I worked in an office in Boston, and I lived in the suburbs. The wake of Moore's son. It happened that the young guy fell or tripped or dodged the wrong way but was not pushed off a subway platform, and swollen skull aside, the knife wound was deemed the cause of death. The news in the office at the last minute said you could go, but you have to sign for annual leave. So Oliver and I are the office representatives. I have to say we are not in the office hierarchy, and that not a single boss shows. Ollie comes over to my desk and asks to borrow my shoe polish. He says, my father would be pissed I show up at a wake without a shoe shine. I mention at this point, do you want to borrow the extra tie in my desk? Oh, yeah, he says. He adds, my father would roll over his casket. He knew I'm at a Roxbury wake. Lenny is out sick. He'll be out for a while, and that is all I'm going to say about it. It could be that some of you know more about it. That's okay. I have no problem with that. I can say that Lenny is optimistic and that he plans to be back. But for now, all I am going to say is that I am in contact with him, and I would tell to you that Lenny is going to be out sick for a while. Thank you very much. I mentioned in this poem a fur coat. It's a muskrat coat, and I want to say it is not a cheap garment. It's fairly expensive. Cindy's fur coat. When no one was looking, I saw him touch a sleeve of her coat gently on the coat hanger. I didn't know why he did it. I mean, it wasn't mink or anything. It looked like made of patches of 50 different kinds of endangered wild rat. And that was one of my Rolling Stone poems. Come along. Armand in the office, the next cubicle over, is always bragging about gifts from his son. A case of motor oil for Christmas, two cases of WD-40 for a birthday. Not only the quantities, but the types of gift were unusual. A half dozen ski masks. I was getting suspicious with some of the presents, a locksmith tool set for Father's Day, a professional glass cutting kit, two different sizes of come-alongs, a set of wallboard knives. Now, come-alongs are winches used to knock down a fence or pull down walls or pull out windows, as one might use to destroy a house or break into one. The son eventually goes to jail, all kinds of burgled items in his condo. I asked Armin recently, how's the Sion doing post-slammer? And you know, the lad is doing great. He has his own business now, selling things on the internet. Armin asked me, do I need stereo equipment? There's always characters in the office, and there's a little Armenian lady in our office who worked night times in the theater district, which was a very, very sketchy neighborhood for a long time, all kinds of lousy bars. Liz and the Chinese audience. Liz Benlian worked a second job as an usher at various theaters in Boston, mainly the Schubert and the Colonial, sometimes the Wilbur. So one night after the show, she's leaving, and two kids grab her purse. Liz does not let go. They knocked her down. She still does not let go. But just at that time, a Chinese kung fu movie lets out its audience, mostly young Chinese men. Liz said it was really beautiful how those nice men moved. Same lady. I don't know if anybody's interested in weaponry, firearms. A Nagant was a French-designed, Russian-made weapon, rifles and pistols. The Nagant. Peter Benlian brought back a couple of souvenirs from the war, and looking through his trunk much later, Liz thought she might find an opportunity to sell the pistol she found. She assumed it was German. It had a star on a handle. Over the phone, the man from the Sportsman's Club sounded very interested. So she arranged an appointment and brings it in her purse. She takes it out and puts it on a table. And four or five men were there. This is Russian, they are saying. And they are oohing and aahing until Liz takes out the other souvenir, the grenade, and puts it on the table. And you never saw people move so fast, she said. They didn't touch it. They just called the bomb squad, at which time Liz put the Nagant in her purse and left. This is a suburb poem, North Main Street. He is walking back and forth in front of the old town hall. His placard is cardboard, maybe 3 by 4 feet, colored red, electric blue, and yellow, the colors of a local pizza place. And he's holding it so it hides his face. He is wearing a hat of sorts with an umbrella top with the same colors. Same as shirt. I walk by and he's on a cell phone, and from behind the placard and from under the hat, I hear him. Yeah, I'm working downtown now. His placard reads, for a very short time only, a very large pizza, 4 toppings, just $4.99. Phone in your order now. He says, yeah, I'm in promotions now. I stop quickly, write down the phone number. I think this will be the last one I read. I don't know how people feel about Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think at his best he probably deserves it, but I don't think he is always at his best. But he had a song, Desolation Row, horrible, gloomy images. So I took that and ran, and I have Jubilation Row. Storyland, Glen, New Hampshire, late summer quiet, the end of the afternoon, and at Cinderella's home, someone did not read the original story that carefully. Home here turns out to be a giant pumpkin. Cinderella is still at home, and she looks Disney princess at the ball, lovely. And also, moreover, she is happy, very happy, doing housework. We asked her why was so much joy linked to sweeping the floor, sweeping the walkway with a straw broom, so much joy linked to a home chore. So we asked her why, and she said, the Storyland cast party was at the castle that very evening, and if we were going, would we not be happy? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael and Paul. There are books for sale at the back, and wow, what a deal. Thanks for coming.